have a couple of minutes if anyone has any questions. I'd just like to start off by saying that nephrology debates are never as much fun as cardiology debates, because we're a subspecialty of ladies and gentlemen. The cardiologists really go at each other, and that's always fun to watch. Just to start us off, I think I heard you both say the same thing, that we can measure it well, but we don't know how to use these objective measures. Is that fair?
I think that's quite fair.
I don't think assistive technologies, we can't truly advocate them right now. They're not ready for prime time. But the point I was trying to make is that I think there may be a space for them, like I showed, like the drip trial I think showed. Some patients, or on average, the patients that are intervened on only had a kilo change in their post-dialysis weight, but they still had an improvement in their blood pressure. This is despite starting at clinical dry weight at the beginning of the trial. If we had some sort of method that could detect that small, subtle volume overload, maybe we'll be able to improve outcomes for our patients, but we just don't have the data to support that.
Okay,
this is a question to both speakers. You talk about technology, and we heard yesterday that the brachial artery blood pressure really isn't very representative of pulse wave velocity and things that are happening in the central circulation. And then Smith and Rahman published a paper 5 or 6 years ago that showed when a clinical nurse specialist took blood pressures 10 or 15 minutes after dialysis using standard American Heart Association standardized cups, they didn't bear any relationship to the blood pressures taken on the oscillometry on the dialysis machine. So my question is, what should we be doing about blood pressure? Frequency? Are there trends? I mean, usually it's 20 or 30 minutes. Should it be every 10 minutes? Is this blood pressure on these machines an appropriate guide? Many years ago, we used to look at the R-to-R standard deviation, the R-to-R wave, as an index of some kind of dysautonomia and whether tachycardia was appropriate. Are there things that we actually could be measuring right now at the chair side that would be more of that, would be assisting us in a way to interpret patients' dry weight? The DRIP study had some significant interdialytic hypotension and some significant problems. They had a couple of unresponsive patients and at least one patient who seized. So it's not completely benign to take 1 or 2% of your dry weight challenge on a treatment.
I'd be happy to answer that. So in the DRIP trial, by definition, the intervention group had to show signs of volume depletion before they were deemed at dry weight. So by design, everyone in the intervention group was going to have symptoms. But I totally agree, it's not benign. Interdialytic hypotension is a bane of the existence of many of our patients. And to answer the question, are there things that we're already measuring on our dialysis patients that might give us a clue towards dry weight? Unfortunately, that really hasn't been looked at, but I think it's an area that should be looked at, should be researched. It's a personal interest of mine. As far as the question of what blood pressure we should measure and should treat, well, that's a whole other kettle of fish. Of course, I work with Rajiv Agarwal, and we're very interested in out-of-dialysis unit blood pressure measurements, and we feel that those are better predictors of the outcomes we're trying to avoid, like left ventricular hypertrophy and mortality, definitely. What I do clinically is I look at on-dialysis blood pressure in two ways. One is we use that to try and avoid symptoms, cramping or crashing on dialysis. But also there is some evidence that the blood pressures on dialysis, if you look at them as a whole, not just the pre and the post, but if you look at the median, if you line them all up and take the median blood pressure, that is a reasonable surrogate for an out-of-unit blood pressure. So that might be a better blood pressure to try and treat. Of course, we don't know what the optimum blood pressure is for our patients.
I had some comments on that. You know, I did a lot of hemodynamic studies in dialysis, and we would always start our studies by doing a half hour of recirculation. And we measured a lot of cardiac outputs, mostly by bioimpedance. And this is a huge change in hemodynamics and a huge drop in cardiac output from what you measure when the patient initially goes on the machine. And then if you just recirculate the blood for half an hour and the patients sit down, settle down in the chair, and a lot of them almost go to sleep during dialysis, just enormous changes in cardiac output, enormous changes in hemodynamics. So it's not surprising to me that the pre-dialysis blood pressure has a lot of chop in terms of predicting anything. And I think this idea of the post-dialysis blood pressure being more representative, I think you guys had some data about the median dialysis
That's right,
pressure
yeah.
during
mm-hmm.
during treatment
mm-hmm.
That is somewhat representative of home dialysis blood pressure and ambulatory. Sure. But the other thing is, I was looking at Rajiv's data where they said, look, yeah, ambulatory blood pressure must be good because it predicts left ventricular hypertrophy. But then when I looked at the correlation value, the R value, maybe I misread it, but it seems surprisingly small.
It was significant but small, but I think the point in that of that was just that you wouldn't use ambulatory blood pressure to diagnose left ventricular hypertrophy, which is what that R value tells us. But it still correlates significantly with left ventricular hypertrophy, an outcome that we're trying to avoid, unlike pre or post blood pressures.
But I mean, unless I'm mistaken, it was less than 0.2 or 0.2. It was very low.
I don't recall. It may have been around 0.2.
It was quite low. Yeah.
Thank you, Pierre de Toronto. Is our problem that we are cannot measure, or we don't consider the concept of the effective ECF volume? If you get pregnant women, they are hypervolemic still, they're hypotensive, and they feel well. The state of tonicity of blood vessels in uremic patients is very high. Most of them very vasoconstricted. If you move to new therapies, and we have a lot of experience with the nocturnal hemodialysis, where sometimes they have very low blood pressure, and we measure with BIA the volumes, and they're elevated, the ratio of extra to intracellular fluid volume in these patients is high, and still they're hypotensive and they feel well. So if you have somebody who is vasoconstricted, if you remove extra fluid, they will become hypotensive because they cannot secrete even more adrenaline to constrict even further. You need pharmacological doses to do that. Versus somebody who is well dialyzed, is relatively vasodilated, or if you try to remove fluids, then they can easily endogenously produce enough vasoconstrictors. So therefore, if you do studies, it's very difficult to put everybody into the same model and decide what's euvolemia versus not. Is the real volume, is the effective volume, which makes more sense to me, but difficult to measure.
So I think to try and boil it down into a question, maybe you're questioning whether even the attempting to develop an objective method is going to be very difficult because of the heterogeneity of our patients. Am I stating it right at least? I think I agree with you completely. The main point I'm trying to make is I think we really need to start somewhere. We need some sort of objective measure. That we can kind of have a baseline that we can compare to and say, well, maybe we have these different types of patients, something objectively that we can use in clinical trials to compare our patients.
And what I'm trying to say, for the same level of vasoconstriction, different volumes will apply and the machines will be useful for the same patient for a short period of time but may not apply to the population of patients or for the same patient under different circumstances.
Well, I think, yeah, what Andres is talking about, this famous lag effect and this idea that sodium accumulates and may also stimulate sympathetic nervous system and change and actually cause inappropriate vasoconstriction. And then after a prolonged period of, this is what the Tassin group showed, that you sort of convert it to a volume-responsive blood pressure after you corrected the initial state of overhydration. And I think the point of your comment is that before you convert from a volume insensitive to a volume sensitive form of hypertension, the optimum blood volume may be different at these different points in time. It does get to be a complicated issue.
I think that was the perfect way to end that particular debate, recognizing the heterogeneity that exists, because that's probably one of the reasons why we've had so many less than positive trials, whether drug or device. So, with that, I'd like to thank our two speakers so much for a really great discussion.